aim to be helpful, not good. I have interviewed Jacqueline Farrington, who is a TEDx senior speaker coach and leadership coach for CEOs, and from the many inspiring things that she has said, this quote was the most beautiful message I have heard from her. We have talked about how to give good presentations in a meeting at work or when you are in a job recruitment process. We have discussed PowerPoint, what you should do with PowerPoint and what you should not do. And at the end, it all comes back to the message of attitude and having the awareness that you are serving an audience, so knowing that you should be helpful, not just good, because this will also boost your self-confidence to present yourself in an authentic way. If you have not listened to the first part of the interview with her yet, I would definitely recommend it to you, and you can find the link to this episode in the show notes. And I have a lot of people in my community or people that I have supported in the past, or also who are listening to that podcast, who are maybe not like speakers in a way of getting in front of a big audience with a lot of people, but let's say people who have more like struggles in their everyday life of speaking in front of others in a meeting at work to really present their core competence, to really spotlight in a way, hey, I am the one who can lead that project, I am the one who qualifies for that promotion, or then in a job interview as well, I am the one qualifying for that job. And that's also why I love your picture with that house, because I mean, this is then not a speech, like especially a job interview, for example, it's not a speech in that way that you could prepare. But I would then think, if it's exactly like you said, like knowing the different chapters or parts of your house, that you have that prepared, like then maybe, you know, whenever a question comes for a job interview about a past experience or where you want to see yourself in the future, that you can take it from there. I think this is now how I would interpret your approach.
Yeah, and if you're practicing for a job interview, enlist the help of friends, family members, colleagues, and you can give them some initial questions. So you can think about, what's the one question I hope nobody asks me? Because yeah, chances are they will ask you something like that. So be prepared. That at least gets their thinking going in terms of the types of questions to ask you. And then have them ask you rapid fire questions, and that you only get 30 seconds to answer it. Mm-hmm. So you've really just, that's not really how a job interview is going to go, but it just teaches again your brain to function under stress, mm-hmm, to deal with failure when it happens in the moment. So rapid fire, 30 second answers, next question, 30 second answer, next question. And that's a great way to think about, what do I really want to say in a job interview? Because it forces you to think more. 30 seconds is actually quite long, but it forces you to think more along the lines of headlines. Mm-hmm. What are the headlines of what I'm saying? Or to your earlier point about speaking in a meeting and wanting to be perceived as a leader in speaking in meetings, an exercise I'll use with clients if they have a PowerPoint deck they're using is to go through the deck one slide at a time, and I'll mix the slides up as well, so they have no idea which slide is coming next. Okay. And I'll make them just give me one headline for that slide. Uh-huh. Boom, next slide, one headline. Boom, next slide. And again, rapid fire. And I'll say to them, the headline has to be like a newspaper headline, 7 words or less. Mm-hmm. What's the takeaway message on this slide? Now, what's the takeaway message on this slide? And so that's a way that you can start to work on brevity and honing in on your message for internal meetings.
Okay, but you're a supporter of PowerPoint. it seems, because I think like it divides people. Like some are like, oh no, not that anymore. Others are like, hey, we always use it. We have to use it in our meetings.
Yeah, and my supporter of PowerPoint, I think it's often a necessary evil. Where possible, I try to get people away from PowerPoint, because certainly we've all been there where someone gives us death by bullet point. And they've got 9 bullet points on their slide, and they start at the top. And even though I've read through all of the bullet points, well, they're just basically starting to speak to the first bullet point. And I think, oh my goodness, they're going to work their way all the way through 9 bullet points.
Yes, I know exactly what you mean.
we've all been held hostage right?
Yeah.
So no, number one, what I try to get clients to do if they do have to use PowerPoint, because sometimes that is just the expectation in their organization.
Yeah.
We expect you to come in with PowerPoint. So one idea per slide, one idea per slide, not 9. So that may mean that you're going through those slides quite quickly. That's okay. Mm-hmm. One idea per slide. Where possible, remember that PowerPoints are visuals. They are not stand-ins for you. They are visuals to support what you are saying. Mm-hmm. And yet you are the main event. Otherwise, why not just send them the deck and let them read the deck? Yeah. And in fact, what sometimes people will do is dramatically simplify their deck and then give a takeaway that has more information in that deck, mm-hmm. so that they can read that later at their own leisure. But one idea, and then thinking about how do I make this as visual as possible? Maybe there is just a picture that I can put on the slide that creates some kind of emotional pulse behind the content that I'm speaking. Or if I'm using a graph or a chart, cherry pick the information that you want to speak to on that graph or chart. You're not going to talk us through the entire thing. Again, what's the take home message to that graphic?
Yeah. Now I wanted to ask something. I've actually lost my idea.
Come back.
Yeah, no, for sure. But then, not really. It's gone. But anyway, okay. Let's say if we continue. I mean, like you or the title of your book, it has that, I think, that really cool title of the non-obvious guide to better presentations, both virtually and in person. I mean, I was wondering, like, what would you say are the obvious things that are not in the book?
What are the obvious things that are not in the book? No one has ever asked me that. What a great question. Okay. I think anyone who's a presenter has read a lot of presentation books. And my experience with a lot of presentation books are they take you through a basic outline for how to write a presentation. And then when they talk about body language, they tend to say, okay, so feet apart, shoulders back, chin up, which is a bit like a military posture.
Yeah.
What I tried to do in the book was to assume that my audience has already some basic understanding of how to present, how to put a basic presentation together, and that I was working with a little bit higher level of sophistication. And by the way, the title, The Non-Obvious, is not my title. That's a series of books.
Oh, okay.
So there are loads of non-obvious guides, uh-huh. Non-obvious guide to emotional intelligence, a non-obvious guide to, I think there's about 12 of them. Okay. And the gentleman who created these books, his idea behind it was it's like having coffee with an expert. Mm. And so the idea behind it is it really is just like sitting down and having I've got my coffee here today, having a cup of coffee with an expert and really being able to focus in on what you want to focus in on. And so the book was not written with the idea that someone would sit down and read it cover to cover. You're welcome to. But my idea behind it was, I want this to be something for my clients that I could say to them, read chapter 7, because I think it'll really help you. And they could dive in and get some down and dirty, fast, practical tips that they can immediately apply to making their presentations better. So the other idea behind the non-obvious guides, and again, this was his idea, not mine, but he bills them as, are you familiar with the Dummy series?
Yes.
All right. So he bills them as smarter and less condescending than the Dummy series to their readers.
Okay.
But not as cerebral and a lot more irreverent than the Harvard Business Review series of books. And so there's, when you read the book, there's a little bit of irreverent humor in there. And it's really about speaking to a very intelligent person who doesn't have a lot of time, who has some working knowledge and experience of presentations, who just needs to give me three things I can do to improve.
Okay. And we will put, of course, like the link to your book in the show notes, that also people have a chance to order it. But what would you say are the three, maybe, or one, two, three gold nuggets that you have in your book where you would say, hey, read it because of exactly that?
Yes. Well, I think the chapter on rehearsal, it's one of my favorite chapters. And we've talked a lot about what's in the chapter there and in terms of how to rehearse and what's important and why it's important to rehearse. I also think that I don't go into a lot of depth on strategic presence. That's the second book. I'm working on a second book on strategic presence, but it's something I'm quite passionate about because for years now, we've been talking about executive presence. And my experience for many years has been with executive presence that it's quite limiting and quite exclusionary, especially in this global economy that we live in. And I, years ago, noticed that in addition to being a speaker coach, I'm also an executive organizational coach. And I noticed that I was having a lot of clients coming in and saying to me, I feel like I have to leave my Koreanness at the door in order to be perceived as a leader at my organization, or I have to leave whatever that is unique to that person at the door to be perceived as a leader. And as I was thinking about it, it occurred to me that executive presence is often a cookie cutter idea of leadership that's set by the guys at the top. And in the US, I said guys very deliberately, because in the United States, sadly still, most of the very senior leaders, most of the C-suite leaders in the United States are still white Western men. And yet that cuts out a whole host of other leadership styles, other value systems, other ways of communicating that are valid and useful. And so strategic presence is a way of thinking about presence that, as we talked about earlier, it's looking at, let me start with myself first. And in my life, I play a myriad of roles. I am an advisor. I am a coach. I am a partner, a wife. I am a daughter. I am all these different things. And even within those roles that I play different roles. If my husband asks me for my advice on something, the way that I advise my husband is very different to how I might advise a client or how I might advise a friend. And there are different values at play in each one of those. And so I'm passionate about strategic presence because I think it allows people to bring more of their authentic selves and more of their whole selves to work. And it gives people greater flexibility in how they communicate and how they connect with audiences. So there is in the first chapter, I talk about presence, and the second half of that focuses on strategic presence and some tips for how to do that.
Mm, okay. Do you have any experience with other cultures? I mean, now I understood you're mainly coaching or working with people in the US. But I mean, I'm a German based in Finland, and already, I mean, it doesn't seem to be that far away from where I come from, and now living in Finland, but there is very, very obvious to see the cultural difference, especially when it comes to presenting yourself in an outgoing way. I don't know how much you know about Finnish people, but they are quite, yeah, quiet, calm, quite shy. Sometimes at work, you really have the feeling you have to shake the person to get something out of them, to get some information, and to have them in a little bit more outgoing way. Do you have experience with coaching people coming from different cultures, and maybe also, yeah, dealing with their mentality that they have gotten?
Yes. So I am in a multicultural marriage. My husband is from Switzerland.
Okay.
And I lived in London for about 7 years. Twice I lived in London.
Uh-huh.
So I worked all over Europe.
Mm-hmm.
And I've also worked in Mexico and in Asia. And so, yes, I do. And I think that, and actually there's a funny story around that. If we have time, I'll share it with you. But I think that often, at least in the US, people believe that if I'm an introvert, I can't be a good speaker.
Mm.
And yet there are numerous examples of powerful introverted speakers.
Yeah.
Nelson Mandela is one who comes to mind.
Yeah, true. Do you know Eckhart Tolle, the German one?
What's that?
Eckhart Tolle.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. Very calm person, but so great. Yeah.
Angela Merkel, not an extrovert.
Yeah. True.
At least doesn't strike me as an extrovert.
Yeah.
But whether you agree with her policies or not, whatever you think of her as a leader, she had to have been doing something right to have lasted as long as she did.
That's true.
And so, there are lots of examples of introverted speakers. And then, you know, certainly when you're communicating across cultures, it's understanding the context in which you're operating and understanding, okay, there are some differences here between my cultural context, and there's the geographical cultural context, but then there's also individual cultural context.
Yeah.
Just because I'm an American doesn't mean that I utilize all of the cultural norms that are typical of Americans. And there's a huge difference between West Coast Americans and East Coast Americans, for example. New York and LA, huge cultural difference. So there's that to consider as well. But it is at least as much as you can familiarizing yourself with what's the cultural context that I'm operating in? What are my cultural preferences? Now, how can I code switch to meet people halfway in order to ease the communications?
Yeah. Now I also remember what I wanted to ask you a couple of minutes ago, because you said that nice sentence, I mean, in a PowerPoint presentation, like, you are the main event, right? And I think I also heard it from you in another podcast interview that I had listened from you, where you said, like, your presentation is a performance.
Yes.
And I really love that as well. And I think, to me, it really sounded like that's really a key point. And I think sometimes I have the impression people are not aware of it, or especially when it comes to, yeah, giving a PowerPoint presentation or giving an online presentation. I think there's, even if you're just looking into your camera, there's a lot of energy just swallowed by that, instead of if you would stand. in front of the person directly, I think we have all experienced that you sometimes sit in front of your laptop and you think, like, I could fall asleep just right now. I mean, what are your tips to really, bring up the fire in people and saying, hey, this is your performance. And no matter if you're an extrovert or an introvert, this is your responsibility and you have to take the lead there.
Yeah. Well, and the reason I say it's a performance is because it's an elevated form of communication. It's not sitting around your dining room table after dinner with a group of friends and family having a glass of wine and just shooting the breeze, just talking.
Yeah.
It requires that you meet an expectation on the part of the audience. The audience shows up expecting you to be prepared, expecting you to entertain them, to educate them, to enlighten them, to engage them. And if those expectations are not met, then to your point, yeah, they start to go, okay, this is just a waste of my time. And time is valuable in this world we live in. So I'm going to go do something else with my time because this is not happening here. So because it's this elevated form of communication, it requires much more of a commitment on the part of the presenter. It requires complete 100% mental engagement with the people in the room, with the content that I'm speaking. It requires 100% commitment physically and vocally. And so one of the ways you can find that fire in you, and I talk about this in the book when I talk about conviction, is to find what in whatever you're saying, and I don't care if it's just a project update, what in the content that you're speaking and the reason why you're showing up here today to ask people give you their attention for 10 minutes or an hour or longer. What resonates with your values? Now, sometimes I've had clients say, nothing in this presentation resonates with my values. I disagree with what it's saying, or I just find it, I'm kind of ticked off, as a matter of fact, that I've even been asked to come in and speak about this. I think it's a waste of time. And that happens. But then it's finding something that resonates with your values around you as a speaker in connection with this audience. If you're really, let's say you find the content really boring, well, then you have a responsibility as the speaker that's bigger than you, much higher purpose than you as an individual speaker. You have a responsibility to either use brevity and make that presentation as brief as possible so that you don't waste people's time, or to find what will matter to the audience and get right to that. Mm-hmm. Or you, let's say, you really disagree with the content that you have to share. Okay, well, then you have a responsibility as a speaker to maybe the audience is going to disagree with what you're saying. So then you have a responsibility as a speaker to find a way to help them connect with that content in some way. And that's tapping into your value system then. That might not be the value that resonates for you, might actually not be rooted directly in the content. It might be rooted more directly in why you're here, and you're here to serve the audience. It's not about you. You're here to serve the audience.
Yeah, I like that. I think, but nevertheless, it's still, it comes back to the self-confidence and the self-awareness part as well. Like, I mean, being aware what my values are and having something in that to identify myself with, and maybe finding that small point that gives me that motivation. Okay, I'm going there and I'm standing there and I'm giving this presentation with a little bit of power and motivation and fire to not waste the time of the audience.
And I would argue that when you recognize your reason for being there is not about you. So one of the things I talk about in the book is aim to be helpful, not good. When we think about, I need to be good in my presentation, I need to give a good presentation, that's all about ourselves. And so all of our attention goes on ourselves. And usually when that happens, that inner critic emerges out of its locked and dark, scary closet and starts talking to us. Why are you doing this way? What are you doing? And our self-confidence goes. But when we aim to be helpful to the audience, I'm here in service of the audience, that often helps boost our self-confidence. And then, to your earlier point, any person, not just a leader, any communicator, any person is always going to be served by self-awareness and understanding, because that is a bedrock of emotional intelligence, and understanding, who am I? What are my values? What are my preferences, cultural preferences, as well as other preferences? What are my triggers? What are things that really send me into an anxiety spiral, and that inner critic emerges? So yes, the more you can know and understand yourself and start with yourself. But I find that aiming to be helpful rather than good is often a really helpful reframe for people.
Yeah, that's a beautiful message. Absolutely. Thank you. Okay, so if we are slowly coming to the end, I mean, people can find, they can find your book and your website. We will put that into the show notes. I think you're also active on LinkedIn.
I am,
is that, yes. Where you share some nuggets from time to time as well?
I do, yes.
Okay, then maybe just as a last question, maybe using the chance here that I have to talk with such a communication expert, what do you think how we are doing in that conversation?
Well, I know, I always think that flow is a great indicator of how things are going, where you kind of lose sense of time and you're very much focused on the other person and just enjoying the back and forth. So if that's any indicator, I was surprised that you said we were coming to the end of the program, and I've just really enjoyed talking with you and sharing ideas back and forth.
Yes.
So nice. How do you think it went?
No, the same. I mean, of course, I tried to watch a little bit at the time, but I could also continue for maybe another hour, because I think it's a topic that we are both super passionate about, and it's just so great for exchanging, and also having a little bit, or sharing your philosophy of these different things which is behind that. Thanks a lot for all your inspiring insights. It was super great to have you here.
Thank you. Thanks for having me on the show. Really great to be here.
Thank you for listening to this episode, and I hope you had some inspiring insights on your journey to spotlight your true self. If you don't want to miss the next episode, then please subscribe to this podcast. And you would make me very happy if you would give this podcast a rating if you're listening on Spotify or Apple Podcasts. And if you would recommend this podcast to your friends, to your family, to your colleagues, or whoever, where you think this person would find support in the topics that I am discussing here. If you would like to follow me on social media, you can find me on LinkedIn and on Instagram under @michaela.kettner.fi. And if you find it challenging to spell my German name, you can find, of course, all the contact details in the show notes of this podcast.